This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The subject of tonight's shiur deals with the extent to which we can and are permitted to coax God into communicating with us. To what extent can we make pacts with Him and say, if you want me to do this, then tell me. If you don't want me to do this, tell me. And this is one of the sources. So tonight's shiur is going to be quite halachic. We're actually going to look at the principles, at the laws of doing that. To what extent we can demand that God communicates with us in situations where we just don't know what to do. Now, in the time of the Torah and of the Tanakh, at least at this phase of the Tanakh, they had, among other techniques, they had the Urim V'Tumim. The Urim V'Tumim was the breastplate that the Kohen used to wear, and on it were gems, one for each tribe, with lettering on each gem, so the name of the tribe appeared on each gem, and a couple of additional letters to make up the full alphabet. That was the breastplate that the Kohen Gadol used, and he was able, please just take a seat wherever you can see one, but if those who are sitting near the back can move a little bit forward so that people who come in late can slip in at the back, that would be better. And the Kohen Gadol had the capacity to pose questions to the breastplate, particularly questions presented to him by the king. When the king faced a national dilemma, he could go to the Kohen Gadol and he could put the dilemma, if it was correctly phrased, to God, and God would answer by lighting up the letters. So one by one the letters would light up and would spell the solution to the dilemma. That was a very useful piece of equipment which the Kohen Gadol used to carry around with him. They didn't use it very frequently. They only used it when there was no way to work these things out rationally, logically, when the king had done all he could to weigh up the two sides and he still was faced with dilemma. It was still unresolved. At that point, they would refer to the Urim V'Tumim and they would question God through the high priest, through the Kohen Gadol. That type of technique is practiced until this day. We don't have the Urim V'Tumim, but we have other techniques. And the question is, how halachically valid? Firstly, how reliable are they? And secondly, how halachically valid are they? One such technique was practiced by the Vilna Gaon 200 years ago, and has been passed down from generation to generation to certain people as to how to do that using the Tanakh. He had a technique that by paging through the Tanakh in a particularly structured way, he could put his fingers on a verse. The verse would contain the instruction necessary to solve the dilemma. That is called the Goral Hagro. It's not something weird and mystical. It's something that an uncle of mine taught me how to do. It can be done. It's used very infrequently. It's used only when it's a matter of communal importance and when the dilemma is not able to be resolved pursuing normal rational means. Then it's possible one can use the Goral Hagro. One does it oneself, or even better, one goes to a righteous person and through him one examines this technique and gets an answer. There are even simpler techniques that often work amazingly. My mother had a little trick that used to work astonishingly well. When she had a dilemma that she couldn't resolve, she used to page through the Book of Psalms and she just used to open it and go back to the first paragraph on that page, or the paragraph starting on the nearest one to that page, and she would study it and find inspiration in it. And the most amazing things she was able to resolve that were so clear, some of them were quite amazing. She didn't tell us of the times that she looked and couldn't find anything, I'm sure there were plenty of those times. But every now and again she showed us the ones that did work, and they were quite fascinating. So there are things, spinning a coin. Say, that, oh, God, help me out on this one. Heads I go, tails I don't. Is that okay or not? Can one do that kind of thing? Just to do it without referring to God, just to say, heads I go, tails I don't, well, what's the point in that? Are you giving the power to the Kohen to maybe that came because they used to give the power to the Kohen, and now they use a Kohen, maybe that's where it came from. But if one were to say, we have other examples of it, for example, drawing a lottery. Saying when one doesn't know what to do, we have many cases of that in the Tanakh itself, in this very chapter. We're not going to do it tonight, but we will do it in the next week or two, where they draw lots. They say, we don't know what to do, God, so you tell us. We'll write things on a piece of paper, we'll put them in the hat, and we'll draw out the one, and that must be it. To what extent are we permitted to, and to what extent is it reliable, to seek answers from God on dilemmas that are unresolvable by normal human logic, where these matters have communal importance? And one of the cases that this whole reasoning is based on is this very chapter, where you'll remember we learned last week that the Plishtim had stripped the Jewish people of all arms and all capacity to manufacture arms. So if anybody needed any piece of metal equipment, they had to go and buy it from the Plishtim, but the Plishtim wouldn't sell them arms. The only two people who had arms was the king, Shaul, and his son, Yehonasan. They were the only two people who had access to arms. You'll remember that there was a Philistine prince was killed, the Philistines, the Plishtim were getting angry, they were mobilizing, there was going to be a war, and the Jews have got no arms. And this was the time we learned last week where they didn't wait for Shmuel, you'll remember, the army deserted. Poor old Shaul, the king, was left with an army of 600 unarmed people against a massing enemy on his borders that he had to try and conquer. Yonasan, his son, sees this and says, we can't leave this to conventional methods. If we're going to leave this to conventional warfare, we're going to be wiped out. The only hope we've got is with guerrilla warfare. We've got to get around to this camp secretly, and we've got to cause massive confusion. We've got to take them by surprise and cause massive confusion there. So he says to his young officer, he creeps off with him, and he says in verse 6, "Vayomer Yonasan el Hanar, Yonasan el Hanar, Noisei Chelov." And the Yonasan said to the young man who was carrying his equipment, "Lechov Nabro el Metzav Ha'erilim Ho'ile." Let us go to the position of these uncircumcised individuals. A derogatory term. It's not an anatomical comment. It's a derogatory term. It's on page 671, chapter 14, verse 6. Ulay yaaseh Hashem lanu, perhaps God will do for us a miracle. Ki ein la Hashem matzor lo shia berov ul bimot, because God isn't impressed by numbers, so it would not be beyond God's ability, obviously, to allow the two of us to wipe the enemy out. It's quite presumptuous, but it's quite logical. It's quite scary, you know. If we're going to use miracles, then numbers are irrelevant. For the 600 unarmed men to destroy the Philistine army is already a miracle. So there's no way we're going to win this war without a miracle. If we're using miracles, we don't have to wait for the 600 to engage in the battle. We can do it ourselves. and his officer said to him, "Be guided by your heart, Yonasan. If you feel deeply inside your heart that that's the right thing to do, then do it. Stretch out and go. I'm with you as long as you are with your heart. As long as you believe passionately in what you're doing, I'm behind you. And Yonasan said, let's see. We'll get behind these people. And from behind, we will reveal ourselves to them. If they say the following to us, Doimu adagienu aleichem, stand still until we come and get you. For amadnu tachteinu, we'll stand where we are, v'loy na'ale aleichem, and we will not engage in battle. Vim koyimru olu aleinu, and if they say, come to us, come, try and attack us. If they invite us into attack, which is what they're likely to say. I think on top, this army sitting on top of the hill, and these two boys, one of them with arms, creeping up the hill, they're going to say, come boys, come, try and attack us. Va'alinu, then we will go. Ki nesonam Hashem b'yodeinu, because God has surely given them into our hands. V'zeh lonu ha'oisim, this is the sign. So he is taking his own life and the life of his officer and probably risking the 600 men and probably the whole nation in a battle, the engagement in which is going to depend on how they answer his question. He's going to reveal himself, and their reaction, their verbal reaction, will determine whether he goes forward or not, based on God's will. So he's making a deal with God. If they say, come and get us, come up here, that means God is telling us to go. If they say, stay where you are, we're coming to get you, we'll run for our lives, because God is saying, don't do it. So when the young man said to Yonason, do what's in your heart. In other words, if you are convinced it's the right thing to do, if you are totally passionate about it, then do it and I will come with you. Yonason says, well, the only way I can be passionate about it is if I know for sure that that's God's will. How do I know for sure it's God's will? We'd better ask God. How are we going to ask God? Here's an idea. We're not going to flip a coin. We're going to reveal ourselves, and depending on their response, we'll know what God wants us to do. Vayogolu shneim el matzav plishtim, and they revealed the two of them revealed themselves to the position of the plishtim. Vayoyim replishtim, and the plishtim said, Hinei ivrim yotzim, the Jews are creeping out of their hiding places. Minachirim asher yizchavu shom, they're creeping out of the holes in which they hid. Vayanu anshei hamatzav el Yonason vel noisei chelov, and the men on the position shouted out to Yonason and to the bearer of his arms. Vayomer, and they said, Olu eleinu, come up to us, v'nedio eschem dover, and we'll show you a thing or two. Vayomer Yonason el noisei chelov. And Yonason said to his arms bearer, Ale acharai, follow me, ki nesonam Hashem b'yod Yisrael, because God has given the Philistines into the hands of the Jews. I know it now for sure. My heart is with me. I'm following my heart. I'm passionate about it. Let's go for it. I'm absolutely convinced this is it. And he goes, and he's successful. Now, we're going to go into this whole issue of using these kind of games with God. We'll start with the Rambam. And I'm going to do a lot of this from the text, because I want you to see the authenticity of it. I want you to see exactly what each one says, so that we can draw some kind of a conclusion from it afterwards. Ein menachashin ke'akum. We are not permitted to play guessing games like the non-Jews do. The idol worship is particularly Shenema, because it says in the Torah, Lo tenachashu, don't guess. Don't play Russian roulette. Ketzad hu anachash, what is this kind of guessing? Kigon elu she'omrim hoyel v'noflo piti mipi, v'nofl makli miyodi, eni hoylech l'mochim ploini hayu. I was going to go on a trip today, I was going to go on a flight, I was going to fly, but a piece of bread fell out of my mouth, and that's a bad sign, so I'm cancelling. My walking stick fell out of my hand, bad sign. That's God telling me not to go. You're not permitted to cancel your flight because of that kind of sign. If you do, you're transgressing a prohibition of the Torah of Lo Tenachashu. Playing guessing games, what do you know? And he gives many other examples. Hoil v'ova shua mi yamini, a fox came past me, a black cat crossed the road, all sorts of things. Certain type of bird sound, all these things that they used to believe in. V'chein ha'meisim simonim la'atzmei. And likewise, somebody who set signs for himself. Im ya'areli kach v'kach e'aseh dover ploini. If such and such happens, I'll do it. V'im lo ya'areli, and if such and such doesn't happen, lo ya'aseh, then I won't do it. Eliezer Eved Avron, like Eliezer. What did Eliezer do? He had to find a wife for Yitzchak. He goes to the well and he says, if she comes and when I ask her for water, she says, I'll give your camels too. That's the wife. Ask the Gemara, and what happens if she would have been ugly and blind and lame? What happens if she was a prostitute? What happens if she was a non-Jewish girl from a completely non-Jewish background? What happens if she was a servant girl? How can you risk your master's life into such a chance Russian roulette? Who knows who she could be? So the Chazal are quite critical of Eliezer. And the Rambam says, if you do what Eliezer does, that's forbidden. If you do what Eliezer did, that's lo tanachashu. You're playing Russian roulette. V'chein kol k'yetze bidvorim ha'ilu. And any such thing, hakol osur, all of that is forbidden. V'chol ha'ose ma'ase mipnei dova midvorim ha'ilu loike. Anybody who does any of these actions has transgressed this prohibition of the Torah and is punished accordingly. Now, some of you know already, but it's some of you who don't, it's an important opportunity to learn about that. The Rambam wrote Jewish law, the way I've just read it to you, extracted from the Gemara with an amazing, authoritative, apparent simplicity. It's easy to find, it's easy to read, it's easy to understand, and he brings no divergent opinions. He doesn't say, some say this, and some say this, and it's a shaila, and I'm not quite sure, you better take the harder. It's just boom, 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 down the line. Every paragraph is a statement of case, law. Case, law. That's it. And there was concern at the time that that could inhibit the continuing evolution of Jewish law. That there was such authority in the Rambam, there was such clarity, that people would stop thinking. Whenever they had a problem, they would look at the Rambam. And that would be then, there would be a cessation of halachic innovativeness. And one of the people, so there were different responses to that. Some people said, well, tough luck, who cares? You've got the Rambam, you don't need halachic innovativeness anymore. Some said, burn the Rambam. So there were people who burnt the Rambam's books. This is a terrible thing he's done, and it's the end of halachic innovativeness. But one of the most brilliant contributions to the debate was made by the Ravid, and he simply goes through and very sharply attacks the Rambam every now and again. And it's always published, in every edition of the Rambam, the Ravid is published alongside. So that as you learn the Rambam, and not just alongside, it's published as an insert, you can't help bumping up against the Ravid every now and again. When you learn the Rambam, you encounter the Ravid's question, which alerts you to the fact that the Rambam is not the last word. That's all the Ravid wanted to achieve. Leave the Rambam, don't burn him, his books are just too wonderful. This is one of the most important things that's happened in the evolution of Torah thinking. Of course we need the Rambam. But we've also got to know that there's a fallibility there. Rambam's a human being, although a very great human being, an incredible intellect, but still a human intellect, and there is place for difference. So the Ravid differs with the Rambam very sharply, and he has the most delightful way of doing it, always a little different. In this particular case, he says the following. Zeh shibush godol. This is an enormous piece of confusion. Which is so nice to see that there's a fearlessness, that when it comes to intellectual integrity, there is a fearlessness. Sharei dover zeh mutar umutar, because this is clearly permitted. V'ulai hit'iyu haloshun. Perhaps he didn't understand the Gemara very well. And I'll tell you the Gemara. So hilarious. And he says some even sharper comments, which we don't need to go into. What is the Gemara he's referring to? So anyway, you see already divergence. You see the Rambam saying, anybody who does this or anything like it has transgressed one of the laws of the Torah. Lo tanachashu. So according to this, no flipping of a coin, no anything, any of this kind of stuff. Work it out yourself, and if you can't work it out yourself, do what you want or do nothing. But don't play these kind of games, that's not allowed. Eliezer did it, Eliezer was wrong. Eliezer shouldn't have done it. Or you might say Eliezer wasn't Jewish. So maybe he was allowed to do it. There's some discussion as to why Eliezer did it. The Gemara is the following. And Chulin Daf Tzadihe, the Gemara says the following. Omar Rav said, Kol nachash she'eino ke Eliezer eved Avrom uche Yonason ben Shul eino nachash. Any guessing game which isn't like the one Eliezer did, all the one Yehonatan did right now in our present piece of Tanakh is not a nachash. It's not a guess. And the Ravid says what the Rambam understands by that is that if it is like Eliezer and like Yehonatan, it's forbidden. If it's not like them, then it's permitted. But the Ravid says that's not the meaning. Let's have a look at that piece of Gemara. What does it mean? Tosfos asks a question. He says the obvious question. V'imtomar Eliezer heich nichesh. How come Eliezer did it? There is a view that a non-Jew is not allowed to do it either. So if this is Russian roulette, how come Eliezer did it? It's all very nice saying that there was a risk and he's chastised for the risk. But why did he do it? Asks Tosfos. Answers Tosfos, he didn't really rely only on the guess. Loi nosan lo hatzmidim ad shehigida loi basmihi. That he didn't give her the jewelry until he checked her family. He said, what family are you from? And when she said, I'm from the family of Betuel and I'm related to the family of Avram, then Eliezer realized this was all Bashert, and then he gave her the jewels. Although the sequence in the Torah is not that sequence, in the Torah it says he first gave her the jewels and then said, having given her the jewels, by the way, what family are you from? Tosfos says the sequence in the Torah is often not chronological, and that the correct sequence was that he first checked her family background. When he heard that it was the same family, he gave it. So he didn't act on that information, only on the information of how she responded. He said, the girl comes out and I say, give me some water, and she says, sure, and I'll give water to your camels. That's the girl. Rivka comes, answers correctly, says, I'll give you water and even your camels. She feeds the camels. Eliezer then says, to double check, so that it shouldn't be roulette, says, what family are you from? It seems as if this might be the girl. She says, from the family of Basur. This is right, then I know for sure God has answered me, and here are the gems. And then Tosfos says, Heich nichesh, how did Yonason? In our case, how did Jonathan play this game, if it's not allowed? Answers Tosfos on that one. He had decided in his mind he was going to go up against the Philistines no matter what. He detected in his officer a certain hesitancy. When the officer said, I'm behind you if you're following your heart, that indicated to Yonason that the officer wanted to be sure that Yonason was sure. How's he going to convince the officer that he's sure? So he tried this. And if the answer would have gone against him, says Tosfos, he would have in any event gone against the Plishtim. That was a rational decision he made, is going against the Plishtim. It wasn't dependent on that. That's a big thing for Tosfos to say, because it doesn't appear that at all from the text. That doesn't appear to be the case, but that's how Tosfos resolves this difficult Gemara. But what we need to do is we need to have a look. There's some interesting things. Did you notice when the Rambam said, anybody who does anything like who? Eliezer and?
Yonason.
Didn't say that. He didn't say that. He just said Eliezer. He left Yonason out. He left Yonason out. Didn't mention Yonason. Although the Gemara says, puts the two together, classifies Eliezer's action and Yonason's action as the same type of Russian roulette action, playing Russian roulette with God, which isn't allowed, says the Rambam. But when the Rambam quotes it, he talks about Eliezer having done the wrong thing. He doesn't say Yonason did the wrong thing. Interesting. Next interesting thing is, there's a medrash that appears in different places, appears in the Gemara as well, in tiny but it appears slightly differently. It says the following. Arbo Shloisha sholu shaloi kohigen ve'yeshivan HaKadosh Baruch Hu kohigen ve'echot shol shaloi kohigen ve'yeshiva amokim shaloi kohigen. Three people asked God for help in an incorrect way and they got answered satisfactorily. And one answered incorrectly and did not get answered satisfactorily. And the four cases are well known. The first one was Eliezer. Eliezer makes this Russian roulette deal with God. First girl who comes and answers according to my predefined formula will be Yitzchak's wife. And the Medrash says she could be a shivcho klani, she could be a slave, she could be a zoyna, she could be a prostitute. Who do you know what kind of girl would come down? Nevertheless, God gives him Rivka. Wasn't a good thing to do, It was a stupid thing to do. But he got Rivka. The next one was Kalev. Kalev said, anybody who conquers Kiryas Sefer, I will give my daughter Achsa to him as a wife. Dangerous thing. Some grand army general comes with no refinement, with no culture, with no wisdom, with no kindness, a brute of a man, and destroys Kiryat Sefer. You're going to marry your daughter to him? Wasn't a good thing to do. But he got away with it. He got Otniel ben Knaz, a wonderful son-in-law. Third one was who? Shaul. Shaul himself says, whoever you later on will come to the Tanakh, whoever can kill Goliath can have my daughter. Silly thing to say. Goliath is a brute, so who's likely to kill Goliath? A bigger brute. Who knows who his daughter's going to land up? Who does he get? The muzzle of a shidduch? King David. He was answered, fortunately, he was answered well. The poor one that didn't get answered so well was Yiftach. When he says, the first thing that comes out of the gate of my yard, I will bring as a sacrifice, and out walked his daughter to welcome him. He didn't get answered so well. He had a problem. But the Medrash classifies all four as Shalu Shaloi Kehoigin. It wasn't the right thing to do. Based on that, the Ran explains that what Eliezer did, what Shaul did, what Kalev did, and what Yonasan did here were not really that bad at all. And that's why God answered them. It wasn't a great thing to do, but it wasn't that bad. Because there was psychological rationale to what they did. It wasn't just a game of chance. Let's look at Eliezer. Eliezer didn't say the first girl that comes out and I don't know what, and then she's wearing a pink blouse, that will be the one. Didn't say that. He tested her response to a moral situation. And the test is a very interesting one. What was he testing her for? To see whether she adheres to the principles of cruelty to animals? What was he testing her for? I'm coming along to say, I'm thirsty. If she says, here's water, my master, drink, and I will give all to all your camels to drink, what is that proving?
Chesed.
What kind of chesed?
To everybody.
To animals. Does Yitzhak want a zookeeper? Or does he want a wife? What does that test? It shows that she's a good zookeeper. She knows how to take care of camels. She loves camels as pets. What does it say about her? It doesn't necessarily say she's a barat. It doesn't mean kind. You know what? The Nazis were very kind to animals. They loved, I don't know about camels, but they loved dogs. And they loved cats. It was just Jews they didn't like. It doesn't mean that because somebody loves pets that he loves people. In fact, you'll usually find it's the other way around. The people who are crazy about pets are usually quite antisocial. People who treat their animals like people usually treat people like animals. I'm not suggesting that people should treat animals unkindly, but one should treat animals like animals in a kind way, but not like people. Once you start treating your animals like people, you're operating in a society that ceases to be able to differentiate between animal and man. And that's not because they've elevated animal to man, that's because they've degraded man to the level of animal. When man has been degraded, you don't differentiate. So what are you proving by the fact that Rivka is willing to feed some camels? You're proving that she likes camels. That's no proof that she's going to be...
She's helping Eliezer out, because he'd have to do that. She's showing him kindness and she's taking care of...
You think
of
he didn't have servants? He came with dozens of servants to help him. He was a wealthy man. He didn't need her to feed his camels. What it did show was an amazing thing. Just picture the situation. She's come with a pitcher of water. She's accosted by this elderly man who says, please, I'm thirsty. Bit of water, please. So any decent person was going to say what? Of course. And probably would help. That's no big deal. So she goes to the well, fills the jug, and gives it to him to drink. Does she take out some glasses and pour them into glasses? Does she decant? No, she wasn't expecting a picnic there. She wasn't expecting to be holding a tea ceremony at the well. So she didn't come with glasses. So what did he drink from? He drank from the pitcher. Now what's she going to do? Refill the pitcher and take it home, this man who could have all sorts of germs, and take it home without washing it before she refills it? Or is she going to refill it in front of him and wash it in front of him and embarrass him?
Practical.
So what does she say? Embarrass him I won't. The only way out of embarrassing him is to feed the camels. Once I've fed the camels, he will understand that I've got to wash the pitcher. It won't insult him. That way I bring a clean pitcher back. What is she proving by that? That she loves camels? That she will never offend another human being. That she's so sensitive she will never do anything to hurt another human being. That's what it proves. That's a valid test. You know what it cost her to feed those camels? How long it took her to feed those camels? How many camels they were? And how camels can drink? She was willing to go through all of that rather than to insult Eliezer by washing out the jug before she refilled it. Those are the kind of midos, those are the kind of characteristics he was seeking in the wife of Yitzchak. So this was no Russian roulette. There weren't many girls that were going to do that. There was only one girl that was going to do that, and that was Rivka. Says the Ran, Eliezer, it looks a little bit as if it wasn't, but the fact is God answered him, and God answered him so quickly, the first girl that came. God doesn't answer you that way if your question had no legitimacy. If you had no business asking it, he doesn't answer you that way so quickly. From the fact that he was answered so perfectly, you can see the question was fully legitimate. That this wasn't Russian roulette at all, says the Ran. What about the next one? Shaul, Kalev, Kiryas Sefer. Kiryas Sefer was a town that Kalev couldn't conquer. Why couldn't he conquer? What does Kiryas Sefer mean? It means the city of the book. These were clever people. These were wise people. Why couldn't he conquer it? Not because he didn't have the brute strength. This needed a strategist of superb ability. Who does he get? Othniel ben Knaz. No chance that some kind of brute is going to conquer the city of Kiryat Sefer. Third one, Shaul. Whoever can kill Goliath can have my daughter. Is there a brute bigger than Goliath?
No.
So whoever kills Goliath is not going to kill him with strength. Because if you come against Goliath with strength, he'll outdo you. He's the strongest man there is. So the only person who's likely to kill Goliath is somebody with brains. So he's not so there's not such a risk. He'll have somebody with brains for his daughter. He'll have somebody intelligent for his daughter. Along comes King David and kills Goliath. What about Yiftach? The first thing that comes out of my gate I'll bring as a sacrifice. That's Russian roulette. There's no test. There's no logic. There's no rationale. And God doesn't answer. First thing comes out of your door, I don't intervene then, says God. You do a stupid thing, like making that kind of statement, and I won't intervene. So whoever happens to come out, coincidence, your daughter, now go and deal with the problems. That was Yiftach. That being the case, let's work out where Yonatan fits. Because Yonatan isn't mentioned in that medrash, interestingly. He's not mentioned at all. And we said there were four people who asked inappropriately. Three were answered appropriately and one wasn't. What about the fifth one? What about Yonatan? That isn't even classified as inappropriate, and yet it's brought in the Gemara as the example of Nachash, of Russian roulette, together with Eliezer. Why is that not inappropriate? Explains the Malbim. He did something very clever. He left God a third alternative. And that's the key to his success. What's the third alternative? They could say, come up and conquer us. They could say, stay where you are, we're coming. Or they could say a limitless number of other things. They didn't have to use those words at all. So what he's saying is, God, if you're not sending me a message, then let them just use whatever words they want to use, and I will then just act on my own strategical decision-making basis. I'll then decide myself. If you are sending me a message, they must use these specific words. If they use this set of words, it means come. If they use this set of words, it means don't come. Do you see the difference between that and leaving God only two possibilities? If you say heads or tails, it has to be one of the two. So how would you know if it's coincidence or if it's real? You can't know. That's Russian roulette. To leave only two options, it has to be one of the two. You have no way of knowing that that's correct. Eliezer, how many options did he leave? Two, either she offers to feed the camels or she doesn't. That's not good. Yonatan didn't leave two. Yonatan left a limitless number of options. And out of the limitless number of options, he selected two that would contain a message. What are the statistical chances that they would answer with those words? Almost zero. So clearly, if the statistics are defied and they do answer with those words, that is a message from God. So he uses statistics to work against, he weighs the probability against the miracle, and then if it's miraculous, he knows it's a miracle. You follow what he does? That's the wisdom of Yonas. But it goes further than that. What does he say? If you look in the words in the Tanakh, there's something very, very interesting. In verse 9, he says, "In ko yomru eleinu," if they say the following to us, "Doimu ad hagienu aleichem," keep still until we get to you, "V'omadnu tachteinu v'loi na'ale aleim," we will stand where we are and we will not go to them. "V'im ko yomru," but if they say the following, "Alu oleinu," and notice how it's worded in direct speech, "V'im ko yomru," colon, quotation marks, "Alu oleinu," those very words, "V'olinu," then we will go up. "Alu oleinu," the translation of that is, in your English it says, "Come up unto us." Do you see that in the third line? It's incorrect. What does "Alu oleinu" mean? "Come up unto us." "Alu oleinu," above us. What do they actually say in verse 12? "Vayanu anshei ha-matzov el Yonasan v'anosei chele v'yoyimru olu eileinu." You notice the difference? "Come to us," not "on us." So they didn't use the exact word, they used almost the exact word. Why does Yonasan still go up? If they say "olu oleinu," "olu eileinu," what are they talking about and why is that relevant? So there's psychology in this too. Firstly, if they say "stay where you are, we're coming to get you," what does that indicate? Fear or fearlessness?
Fearlessness.
If they say "come and try and attack us, we're staying right here, we're waiting," what does that indicate? Fear. Right? If you invite them to come to you, that's fear. You're afraid to go out. When you're fearless, you pursue. The pursuer usually wins. It's not that often that the pursued wins. And he detects the fear that would exist in their invitation to come up. But more than that, there is, we see it a couple of times in Tanakh. We see it with Eliezer, in fact. When Eliezer, some of you remember the story, Avraham calls Eliezer, his servant, and says, "I need a wife for Yitzchak. I want you to go to this distant place where my family lives and look out there and check out and see a nice lady and bring her back." And after he goes through the whole thing, Eliezer utters his famous words and says, "Maybe despite my best efforts, she won't want to come with me. Maybe I'll find a nice girl, but she won't want to come. Will you agree to send Yitzchak there? What should I do under those circumstances?" And for the word "ulai," which means maybe, the Torah writes it as "eli," leaves out the vav, which means "eli, if she doesn't want to come, can my daughter marry Yitzchak?" There was a subconscious Freudian slip in the way he pronounced the word that indicated to Avraham that Eliezer had self-interest in marrying his daughter to Yitzchak. So we have situations like this in the Tanakh where different spellings of the same word indicate a Freudian slip of meaning. So what is Yonason saying here? If they say "alu eleinu," and it sounds like "alu oleinu," there's a Freudian slip caused by their fear. Come on top of us. Conquer us. It's an invitation to conquer. And that's a sign of the weakness. So not only is he waiting it statistically against the miracle, he's saying there is psychological basis to it as well. So classifying it not as the type of thing that Yiftach did, where there's no psychological reason at all. Whatever comes out of the door, I'll bring as a sacrifice. That's not what he's doing. There is a psychological basis for it. He's saying, I detect fear if they say, come up and get us. There is fearlessness if they say, we'll come and get you. So I'm playing on two things. Number one, we'll test the psychology of the enemy. Number two, we'll test God's will. God, if this is just coincidence, let them use any words they want. And then I'll take it as no instruction from you. If you are instructing, let them use those specific words. If it's come up and get us, we'll attack them. If it's stay where you are, we're coming to get you, we'll pull out. And that explains why the Rambam leaves out. It's very hot, isn't it? But don't worry, because I'm going to finish in a few moments. I obviously haven't turned on the air conditioning. Don't worry, y'all. I'm going to stop maybe for tea, though. It would be nice to have the air conditioning on. That's why the Rambam, when he says what's forbidden, he brings Eliezer, he does not bring Jehonatan. Because Eliezer leaves God two options. That's not fair. Because it has to be the one of the two, and you'll never know if it was coincidence or not. So don't put God in a situation where you can't determine whether this is coincidence or it's God talking. You want a message from God? That's fair enough. But create an opportunity where it's statistically loaded against God communicating. And if despite the statistics God does communicate, then listen to what he's saying. Because that's a message. And that's how the Rambam paskens. So we see the beauty of this and how he does understand the Gemara very clearly, despite what the Ravid says. He understands the Gemara very clearly, and there is a differentiation. What Eliezer did wasn't right. And the Medrash makes it clear it wasn't right. God answered him because there was psychological depth to what he said. It wasn't completely wrong. But what Yonatan did was completely right. There was nothing wrong with what Yonatan did. Because Yonatan left God a wider range. Let's summarize that, and then I'm just going to add one element, which is the Radak, which is rather important. What we're saying is, there is a prohibition in the Torah of Loi Tanachashu. Don't play Russian roulette with God. Don't make signs. One thing is clearly forbidden, and that is superstition. So to have a standard event that turns you off an action, that's not allowed. So I believe that if stick falls out of my hand, bread falls out of my mouth, black cat crosses the road in front of me, that's a bad sign, forget it. That we're not even allowed to think that for a moment. It's irrelevant. It is totally irrelevant if any of those things happen. However, what about creating signs? Saying before the event, if a cat crosses the road, that means something. As I'm going down the road, if a cat will cross the road, then I won't go further. What about doing something like that? No, it can't be something without any psychological basis. There has to be a rational basis even to that. Can't leave it to cats. Cats don't have brains. Don't have human brains. You've got to, if you're doing it, there's got to be some kind of psychological rationale over and above the communication from God. God never allows us to abandon our minds. He never allows us to abdicate the responsibility of decision making. So even if we're engaging God in a discussion, we have to take charge of some of the reasoning. So it has to be like a King Saul. I know that the person who killed Goliath will be intelligent, at least that. Like Kalev saying, I know the person who conquers Kiryat Sefer will be wise. Like Eliezer saying, I know the woman who gives the water to the animals will be kind, will be sensitive. There has to be a psychological element to it. So if you're going to say anything, you can say, I'm not going to walk into that room full of people if the first person I greet there doesn't greet me back. That's a sign to me that I'm not very welcome there and I'm going to leave the room. I'm not going to go in. That's okay. There's a psychological basis. You're testing the atmosphere. That's a sign from God that I'm not wanted there. That's okay according to most, but not even that according to the Rambam is not good enough. According to the Rambam, there has to be an additional requirement. And that is that the statistical chances of your sign working are nearly zero. Then, if the sign works, you can have your two options. If this happens, it means this, and if that happens, it means that. But you're leaving a big opportunity for nothing to happen. So that you can test whether this is coincidence or this is God's intervention. The Radak adds an additional dimension which is quite important, and he brings a Gemara that is a Gemara, believe it or not, that says in three areas you can be superstitious. A home, marriage, and a birth. If just as you buy a new home and you're about to move in, funny things happen, bad things. Take note. If just as you're about to get married, funny things happen, things just keep on going wrong. All right. Take note. If just before you have a baby, funny things seem to be happening, take note. What does that mean? Only in those three areas. There are a few conditions to that. The first condition is at least three good or bad things need to happen. One or two doesn't make any difference. That's a principle generally in Jewish law. Once or twice we consider coincidence. You can't draw a conclusion from something happening once or something happening twice. When something happens three times, you're entitled to assume that there's a common cause for all three times. And in the case of a new home, a marriage, or a birth, if there are three good signs consecutively, or three bad signs, you're entitled to say, this is God talking. Now comes the beautiful innovation of the Radak. And what can you do about it, says the Radak? You can't back out of the deal. You can't say, bad sign. I was about to buy this house, there was an earthquake, and there was a crack in the wall. And then a few days later, somebody threw a ball at the glass and the whole pane of glass broke. And the very next day there was an electric short and there was a fire in the kitchen. Three things in 2 days, just as I'm about to move in, I'm not going. Can't do that. That's loitzer nachashu, that's abandoning intellect. You cannot abandon intellect. All that can make you do is say, I'm taking off work tomorrow, I'm taking a tehillim, and I'm praying all day. This is a message from God that he wants closer contact with me. This is not a message from God to clear out of the house. God doesn't do those kind of things. If I'm going to buy a house or not, that's my decision, and God won't take those decisions. It's amazing how adult we have to be, and that's the principle of loitzer nachashu. Loitzer nachashu is don't shove your thinking onto God's plate. Make your own decisions. And God will never interfere. All he will say is, a bit more prayer, a little bit more charity. You need a bit of help. This is a big step you're taking. You don't really deserve this beautiful house. Do something nice for me, and then I'll help you. That's all he's saying. He's not saying don't move into the house. About to get married, things aren't going wrong. You went through all the rationale. You've decided this is the woman you want to marry. You have reasons for it. Three bad things happen. Marriage, you don't really deserve it. You better go and give some extra charity, pray a little bit, learn a bit of extra Torah, do some kindness to some people, become a better person. That's what God's saying. And we never think of that possibility. Isn't it interesting? With our superstitious little minds. What do we always think? Oh, God is telling me. I'm so important that God is telling me, don't move into the house, don't do this business deal, don't travel on this journey. God doesn't do that. God says, I gave you a brain. You can work it out yourself, and I will back your decision. If you've worked it out using proper logic and using halachic methodology, and you've come to the conclusion that this is what you want to do, I'll back it. All I'm saying to you is, if you want me to back it, invest a little more. That's what it means. A very different perspective. That's as far as we can take superstition. But not to change our actions. That we can never do. Those are the principles of using all sorts of external signs. The principle is very, very clearly, nothing can take the place of your own analysis. Nothing can take the place of your own decision making. God has given you an intellect, and he's given you principles by which to make decisions. There are halakhic guidelines that cover every type of decision making you can imagine. Halakha doesn't only govern whether you should put your tefillin on your left hand or your right hand. It governs the way you set about any analysis, any decision making. And provided you're following that methodology, whatever decision you make, God will back. If you're getting positive signs, you know God is really happy with your decision as you stand. If it's in those three areas, only those three areas, interestingly enough, for whatever reason. If you're getting negative signals, he wants a little more from you. But he's never saying to you, I want you, even though you've worked out rationally you should do it, I'm telling you, don't. God doesn't do that. God leaves it to us and backs our decisions. Occasionally, particularly when matters of national or communal importance are concerned, we can use these techniques, such as Yonatan used, or according to some, the techniques that Shaul used and that Eliezer used. But if we go according to the Rambam, we can only use the ones that Yonatan used, where we leave God the option of leaving it to coincidence and making it very clear that there's no message at all, but providing the opportunity for God to send a message if there is a message. The one condition is, if we do that, Rashi lays down the condition. And Rashi says, Somech olov mamosh ke'eliezer eved Avron. You've got to rely totally on it then. if you play this game, you've got to stick to it. And that's a condition also with the Ger al Hagro that I told you about, the way that the Vilna Gaon's methodology of using it from the Torah works. It doesn't work if there's hesitation in your mind. You can't say, well, let me ask it. And then you ask it and it gives you the answer, and it's not quite the answer you were looking for. Maybe that's not what it means, and maybe it's just coincidence. No, you can't do that. You've got to be sure before you engage in this kind of game that you're going to go the whole way. And that if you've done it right and you've left the opportunity for coincidence, you've then created the other opportunities, you've put the dilemma, you see what happens. If the answer is clear, you do it. That's how one then has to do that. And one has to be sure that one is willing and capable of doing it. But that's a very rare circumstance. Far more frequent is the normal kind of decision making that people go through and seek God's blessing and God's encouragement rather than God's capacity to make the decision for you. That gives you some idea of the parameters of the principles of the mitzvah, of the isur, of the prohibition, of nichush, of this game of Russian roulette with God and the abdication of intellectual responsibility. Mr. Littman.
How does astrology fit into the
question? Yeah, very good point, and exactly in the same way. Well, you can work it out yourself, isn't that so? How would it fit in? An astrologer says you should buy a house. What should you do?
This is a good time for you. This is going to be a good period for you, or a bad period for you, or something like that.
So what should you do? Ignore him.
Are we allowed to
give him? Ignore him. It's irrelevant. That doesn't mean he doesn't have the capacity to identify trends. If he's a genuine astrologer, they do have. And we know from the Torah that astrology is a science. That it does have the capacity. But that can't make your decisions. All that can happen is, if you've decided to go into a business deal using your business cup and your halakhic guidelines, and your astrologer who you frequent every week says to you, no, not a good time, then a little bit of extra davening, a little bit of extra charity, a little bit of extra kindness, because then you say to God, seems it's not a good time, but I've decided I'm doing it because from a business point of view it's the right time. So since it's not a good time astrologically, I need some extra help, God. So it increases the prayer level. If the astrologer says great time, then it's good for you, it makes you feel nice about it, so it's fine. And you don't resent paying the astrologer's fees. But to make a decision based on the astrologer's statement is a prohibition of Leut Nachshu as well. Absolute prohibition.
So it's a good time to give it a blessed tzedakah?
Yeah. Looking for excuses to give less tzedakah.